Es un gran honor tener aquí a Robert Wallace. Hablamos de uno de los mayores conocedores del derecho griego antiguo al mundo actualmente. Además, es una persona de una cultura increíble que tiene 5 campos de investigaciones importantes, porque va seguramente de la literatura antigua, el derecho seguramente antiguo, pero también la filosofía, la historia y la historiografía, y también se ha ocupado y se ocupa de numismática. Hablará hoy de Atenas
y la música.
Y la música. Hablará hoy de Atenas y el sentido de del derecho y de la comunidad, ¿no? A través también de la figura de Sócrates y del proceso a Sócrates. Así que, vale, es un honor, lo repito, porque no siempre tenemos la ocasión de escuchar a un estudioso tan importante. Y, por favor.
Great. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. The title of my talk, Prosecuting Socrates, Law and Community in Ancient Athens, touches on a critical problem which historians of Greek law confront every day. And that is the roots of our particular field come from German legal historians. The first great scholars of Greek law were Germans, in particular a man called Hans Julius Wolff. And German legal historians were all Romanists, and many of them were practicing lawyers and continue to be. Eva Cantarella, our friend, is a practicing lawyer. She has a law degree, although she is a classicist as well. And so the founders of our discipline were jurists, used to a tradition of jurisprudence, of people who studied the law and compared different laws, tried to work out the principles of law to make law a coherent discipline. The Greeks invented law. In as early as Aristotle refers to a law with an Olympic dating of 728 BC, the first law that we know of, regulating inheritance and property in Thebes. So the Greeks invented law, but they did not have a tradition of jurisprudence. They invented law for many reasons, but the main reason, the most important reason, is that justice had been, dispute resolution and justice had been administered by the big men, the basileis, which means kings, but the Greeks didn't have kings. They had important men. And we hear in Homer, we hear in Hesiod, anger at what the Greek people called the crooked judgments of the big men. The big men who took bribes to affect the resolution of disputes. And so, for example, Athens' great lawgiver Solon says in his poetry, this is 594 BC, he says, I wrote straight justice, not crooked justice, straight justice, equal for the elite and for ordinary people. Equality was an idea that the Greeks had as early as we can see. In the Iliad, Achilles, Agamemnon, a big man, takes the prize of Achilles, another big man. And Achilles says, you can't take my prize. We are equal, you and me. You have no right to take my prize. And in the Iliad, it's so extraordinary. People have not seen this. Equality is everywhere in the Iliad. Who divides when they capture a town? And there is booty. There are gold and silver things to distribute. Who distributes them? The people do, the demos. And they make sure that everybody gets an equal amount. This is an extraordinary new development in the study of Greek law. The sense of the importance of the people and the importance of equality is there from the beginning. We have an idea that early Greece was like the Middle Ages for us. A powerful class of knights and kings and rich ladies and then the peasants. In Greece, it wasn't that way. It's extraordinary that after the Dark Age, in the Dark Ages, everybody seemed to be equal. There were no kings. When they needed a leader, when a community needed a leader, they picked one, the strongest. But if he ceased to be strong, they got rid of him and picked somebody else. Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, is not automatically the king of Ithaca. He has to be the strongest, or a suitor, one of the other people, becomes king. The whole thing is really the most extraordinary thing. So, law, but then, maybe around 725, we first see signs of richer people and poorer people. And already in Homer, we get complaints about the big men who are taking too much and are robbing the people. And right away, we get the first response from the demos to this, which is law. Rules which they carve in stone and display in public. Here's the rule. If you kill somebody, here is the punishment, and here is the procedure to bring it to court. The judge, the jury, provisions for a pardon, or if it was unintentional, they start thinking about this very early. Now, laws didn't work by themselves, as the Greeks found out, because there's a famous sage, a wise man called Anacharsis, who said, laws are like spider webs. They trap the poor and weak, but the rich and powerful tear through them. And so the Greek solution then was to have tyrants and aristocrats. Tyrants were originally good. A tyrant said to the demos, I will protect you. And the people, they were originally popular figures. The trouble was that the Greeks didn't foresee that when the tyrant dies, it's too risky to have his son take over, because the son may not be as good as the father, and also power corrupts. So they got rid of tyrants. And then they introduced another great invention of the Greeks, the constitution, the written constitution. The Greeks discovered that by writing 6 lines of text, you can change everything. Who has the power? How often the assembly meets, how much power does a king have, the officials have. They wrote this down. It was a monumental discovery. And by the way, the Greeks had already discovered the principle of the majority, that if more than half of the people vote for something, that decides it. And so, and we see this all through Greek history, Thucydides says, the Athenians decide to do something. He doesn't say 51% of the Athenians decide to do something. Once it's decided, everybody goes along with it, which is a miracle. Think in our world how decisions, votes, don't really decide things because they're still the unhappy 49% who say, we're not going along with it. It's an extraordinary discovery the Greeks made. Principle of the majority. The power, Aristotle says, in the politics, in every type of government except tyranny and monarchy, the assembly has the power. The people gathered together decide. In Homer, there's a council of nobles, or big men. They argue among themselves, but they never decide. Then each one of them goes out and addresses the army. In Homer, it's an army, the assembly, and tries to convince them to accept his view. And then another leader comes, take my view. It's the people who decide. And that happens everywhere. You all, if you study Greek history, you will read that decisions in early Greece were made by a council of powerful men. But if you look at discussions of this, do they give an example of this? They only give one example. The Senate of Republican Rome. There is no Greek example. Our colleague Mogens Herman Hansen in Copenhagen wrote a history of a constitutional history of every Greek polis. I looked through every one. There is no government by a council. It's remarkable. So, the Greeks invent law primarily to protect the people from the newly emerged powerful group who stole from the people, they indulged in fancy eating and drinking and build big houses. They stole from the people. And so the people got together and says, we're going to make first laws, then we'll make constitutions, then if those don't work, we'll make a tyrant. And finally, they settled on constitutions. And that became the permanent answer. The laws, even though they were supplemented by other things, continued to have great power. In Athens, the city-state we know best, the dikastai, we call them jurors, dike is the word for justice, so these men, dikastai means justice men. The justice men were often called guardians of the law. The conception the Greeks had was that in court, the law ruled. That the dicasts, as we call them in English, the dikastai, had to guard the law. Athens soldiers swore every year to obey the officials and the laws. If anyone seeks to destroy the laws, I will oppose him as far as I can. When the Athenians republished their laws in 403, they preserved the archaic language of the old laws. They didn't change it because the text of these laws was so important. It was a capital offense. You were executed if in court you cited a non-existent law. If you said in court, there's a law that says X, and there was not, you were executed. the graphe paranomon, a suit for proposing a decree or a law which conflicted with another law or decree. It was formally illegal to introduce in court irrelevant material. The Greek said to speak exo tu pragmatos, outside of the matter at hand. So you had to, by law, you had to say only things in court that were relevant to the case. So I'm making 4 points here. First point, equality. Justice meant equality of treatment. Second point, the laws were considered nearly sacred. You had to obey the law. Third point, the laws were made not by a small group of legislators, but by the assembly. They passed, the community passed the law, not an elected a legislative body. In the United States, in a U.S. court, the judge tells the jury the law. Here is the law that this person is accused of breaking. The jury, which is typically 12 people, chosen out of the telephone book, chosen at random from the population. I've done this twice. It's most interesting because everybody takes it very seriously. Everybody there. There are all sorts of people, 12 people in this room. A lawyer, somebody, a truck driver, a teacher. Everybody tries to find the right solution. It is most interesting. So the judge says the law. The jury decides, did the defendant break the law? And then the judge decides the penalty. Now, in ancient Greece, that the Greeks had no judges because that would give too much power to a single individual, which they did not like. So there's no judge. There is the defendant and the prosecutor, and there's no judge. There's a court official to maintain order, but there's no judge sitting there saying, no, no, you can't say that, that's irrelevant. There's no person like that. So there is only the jury, which you can call lay judges, amateur judges, because they making all the decisions. And the judges are very many. There are, in private cases, what we call torts, but disputes between two people. There are 200 or 400 jurors, dicasts. In public cases, like that concern the whole community, like impiety or murder, although murder is a special case, we'll come back to that if we want. Juries were minimum 500, could be 1,000, 1,500. One jury is 6,000 people. The idea is this represents the community. So instead of a judge having power, it's the community that listens and decides. And the jury was picked at random. You had to volunteer for jury service, and if you volunteered, your name was put in a hat, and when they needed jurors, they pulled names out of the hat on the day of the trial. So nobody knew what case he was going to hear. So third point, Athenian justice is community justice. It's the people all together who decide. Fourth point, there were no lawyers or other experts. The Greeks did not tolerate experts. They mistrusted clever speakers. We have this problem in our own society. Lawyers are clever speakers. And often, injustice occurs because somebody has a clever lawyer. The Greeks didn't tolerate. The prosecutor had to speak by himself. The defendant had to speak by himself. And there was no judge to say, that's irrelevant, you can't make that point. There was no control. So each juror of the 200 or 500, each juror had to listen and try to make up his own mind what was fair, what was just. They weren't allowed to talk to each other, because somebody could influence somebody. Some more important man in the jury could say, listen, folks, I know what's happening here. Don't go along with this. No, that was forbidden. No talking. And you voted immediately after the testimony. The idea being that each citizen had to decide for himself what was right and fair in this case. Now, there is one big problem. There are many problems, but here's one big one. We have a lot of speeches preserved from ancient court cases, and many of these speeches contain material that we would call irrelevant. It's as if in a modern court, somebody got up and said, well, let's not talk about the crime I'm accused of. I'm a great guy. I've done good for the community. I have served well in the army. And so you should acquit me, because I'm a good guy. We can't say that in our courts, I don't think. But the Greeks said that all the time. So, for example, here is Lysias, the Athenian speechwriter, Lysias. He says, my opponents cannot even use the expedient so common in Athens of saying nothing about the accusation, but saying other things about themselves. They deceive you. They show that they were good soldiers or had captured many ships of the enemy. They're a whole... Isocrates, who's a rich man and a conservative, he says, in early Athens, judges enforced the laws on lending money. So if you borrow money, you've got to pay it back. He says, but now the jury yields to sympathy, and they look at this poor guy who owes money and says, oh, well, you've had a hard time, so we're going to let you off. all this kind, it's amazing. The texture is quite different. And I was reminded, I once met a charming Italian count who collected antiques. And he was at a mostra, an antique show in northern Italy. And he was outraged by the lack of security. So he picked up some object, walked all the way around the room with it, and left, and nobody stopped him. So he went back in, and he got mad at the single policeman there. He said, I just stole this piece, and you didn't say anything. And he was put in jail for stealing. And he was brought up, he said, he's a conte, he's a count, he's a prominent Italian citizen. He said, the food in prison was il riso era molto buono, ma non c'era la scelta, there was no choice, but the rice was good. And he said, in court, my lawyer had an excellent defense. His defense was, what is a man like this doing in prison? But there, of course, encapsulated there, is the injustice of Vecchia Italia, of the nobility getting to do what they want to do. Whereas These are somewhat, these examples, we'll come back to them. They're fascinating to look at. Because these are ordinary people saying, I fought for you. Sometimes they bring their children into court. I'm a family man. So this Conte is not going to bring his children into court. He says, I'm an aristocrat. Let me go. So this is an important point. We will come back to it. So these statements, which we find all over the place in Greek legal sources, have led to a major debate, modern debate, whether Athens really was the rule of law. If in an Athenian court you could say, I'm guilty, but don't worry about that. I'm a good citizen. How is that the rule of law? So some scholars respond, like Adrienne Lanley, I don't know if you've ever heard of her. She teaches at Harvard Law School, but her special interest is Greek law. She says, well, if you look at what these people say, it's usually something related to the whole story of the lawsuit. And therefore, it can be included. Or sometimes these details can encourage what we call jury discretion. That in a particular case, strictly enforcing the law won't yield what ordinary people would consider to be justice. And so you make an exception. This happens in every legal system, I guess. It happens in ours, in the United States. But I don't believe this with Lonnie's point. This is a desperate effort to claim that Athens was simply the rule of law. That these digressions, saying, I fought hard for Athens in the army, that that's relevant to the legal case. It is not. Other scholars say Athens was not the rule of law. Even though many, many sources say, these same legal speeches say, we follow the law. But then they give examples of fighting in the army or capturing a foreign town. So here is the Israeli scholar, Gabby Herman. He says, it was not the juror's concern to find out the truth. It was their task to weigh the relative merits of the arguments they heard with an eye to the city's interest. Whoa. Any idea, this is still Herman, of ascertaining the facts and testing them against the letter of the law was paid no attention to. Whoa, that's very strong. And there's another very brilliant legal historian called David Cohen, who teaches in Berkeley. He says mostly legal disputes were not central to court cases. The cases were primarily contests for social honor and the prosecution of legal feuds, long-standing feuds, here carried out through the courts. Now, so this is a major problem. And it, as we will see when we talk about the trial of Socrates, was Socrates actually convicted for the charge that he was brought up on? And I think not. But so there's another case where the jurors, a big representative, and for Socrates' case, at least 500 jurors, convicted Socrates, as we will see, probably not for something that he was charged with. So we will come to this. These are very important issues here, but there, I'm going to suggest that there is a solution. And the solution, I'll tell you at once, is this. That laws were created in ancient Greece to protect the community against the powerful and wealthy and the upper classes who were used to doing whatever they wanted to do. And so, if you look at these examples, which I didn't read all of, but I'll mention these. If you listen to the examples, and when I gathered these sources, I didn't have this idea in mind, but all of them say, I protected the community. That's what they all say. And instead of the count saying, I'm a great man, I shouldn't suffer. So here, listen to this. So the first one, the expedient of saying you are good soldiers or captured many ships, you can mention brave deeds by ancestors, prove you served the city well, to be kind to those who were not rich and had to borrow money. Now here's an interesting one, Demosthenes 25. Before now I have seen some men on trial being convicted by the actual facts and unable to show that they had not done wrong. Take refuge in the moderation and self-control of their lives. Others, in the achievements and public services of their ancestors, through which they induced their judges to pity and goodwill. Now, what's interesting about that example is the words moderation and self-control. These are traditional aristocratic virtues, sophrosune, temperance, because precisely the problem of the aristocracy was they got drunk, they fought, they behaved terribly. That's the driving force of Greek history. Aristocratic misbehavior, which compelled the Greek demos, the people, to first invent laws, then install tyrants to control the aristocracy, and then have constitutions, all of them giving formal power to the demos. Look at Sparta. Sparta's the most extraordinary thing. Sparta did not accept an aristocracy. They never had one. Their constitution is the first one we know. It's from 670 BC. And there are six lines. And the last line says, and the victory and the kratos, the power, will be with the demos. So there it is. The first actual attestation of democracy. And every decision we know that we can tell from the sources that was made by Sparta was made by the people in assembly. There was nobody else. It's extraordinary. So, the origin of law came about by the need to protect the community. And so in court, the same speaker says, you must not tolerate irrelevancies. And then he goes on to say, and my ancestors fought for you and died for you. Why is that not irrelevant? It's not irrelevant because the point of law is to protect the community. And the guy says, I protect the community. So that's how they understood this. It still seems difficult for us. We think it's still irrelevant to the case, but not for them, because the community was the most important thing. And every discussion of the law in these speeches stresses that it protects the community. Here is Andocides, an orator. He says, Andocides says, the law is safety for everybody. Anybody who ignores the law has destroyed the greatest protection of the city. Here is Aeschines, another orator. If the laws are faithfully upheld for the city, the democracy also is saved. Here is Euripides in the Suppliants. Fairly preserving the laws is the bond that guards all men's cities. I have a dozen examples like this. So, laws and community worked together. The laws protected the community, and it was perfectly legitimate to stress in your defense that you too worked for the community. Now, let me compare this briefly with what we do in the United States. Our legal system operates according to modern liberal values. Now, liberal, I guess, is a term in Europe which means something different than it does in the Anglo-American community. Liberalism is a progressive sentiment. It's a generous sentiment. It's the sentiment that allows us to welcome immigrants and to provide for the poor. This is liberalism. The conservatives hate all this. The conservatives say, no, we're not going to give anybody anything. If you want a house, if you want food, you've got to work for it. That's conservatism. Liberalism says, be kind to people. A central tenet of American liberalism is the primacy of the individual over the state, and the paramount importance of protecting individual liberties against too powerful government. Some of you have probably seen on TV, American TV, the police, when they're arresting somebody, they read him his rights. We call them Miranda rights. You have a right to, before we take you in, we say you have a right to a lawyer, and if you talk to us, anything you say, we can use against you in court. Every person who is arrested hears these words to guarantee so that a person knows I don't have to talk to the police, especially if I don't have a lawyer. You don't have to talk to the police if you don't have a lawyer present. But if you don't know that, you might say something. So the police have to tell you, you have a right to a lawyer. And if you can't afford one, we'll give you one. So all of these rules protecting ordinary citizens is in part a product of the struggle against what is called the heavy state. Where regimes or faceless bureaucrats dominate an alienated populace by what the sociologist Max Weber called a monopoly. What the police have is a monopoly of legitimate violence, including censorship and taxation. In the United States, the legal system is so far oriented to protecting individuals against the state that people who, criminals who are clearly guilty, who even say, I'm guilty, they are let go. If the state has committed some even minor procedural offense, like not reading somebody his Miranda rights, we catch people with drugs in their cars. But if the police did not have a legitimate reason to stop that car, they couldn't just say, well, that we know that guy's a drug dealer. They can't just say that. They've got to have a specific reason to stop the car, Otherwise, the drug dealer is let go because the state has overstepped its bounds. The American Civil Liberties Union opposes sobriety checkpoints, testing just having a control on the highway. Breathe into the machine, are you drunk? The American Civil Liberties, you have no cause to stop somebody. If the guy's weaving, fine. But if he's just driving normally, you cannot stop him. And the same at airports. They think it's illegal to examine every person going through security because you have no grounds to examine me. You have no reason to pick on me. So this is our protection of individuals against the state. And for the same reason, in the United States, we tolerate what we call civil disobedience. So if you object in the Vietnam War, many people objected to that war. The boxer Muhammad Ali said, I got no complaint against the Viet Cong. And we thought, that's okay. You don't have to fight. If you object to it, you don't have to go. That was the American people. And Greenpeace, we're happy to let Greenpeace go because we think the work they do, it's illegal, but it's good. So let them, the average person says, let Greenpeace go. In ancient Greece, this never happens. Nobody can put his own ideas ahead of the community. There is no text where somebody says, I put my family or my own ideas ahead of the polis. Even conservatives, aristocrats, all say, no, the community comes first. Here is our friend Andocides, the orator. Those who do not identify their interests as individuals with yours as a community can only be hostile to the city. Here's Aristotle. The city-state comes before any household or any individual because the whole must be prior to the part. And we have many court cases where people go through their whole lives and say, Hyperides, an orator, says, a judicial verdict should be based on a whole man's whole life and not just the case. And there are many passages which confirm this. The same guys say the law is critical. So they believe these two things together. The welfare of the community and the strength of the law are two values that come up against each other. And so how are these problems resolved? One way of resolving them is through the nature of Attic law. Athenian statute law is very vague. The statute says, if you commit the crime of impiety, then the following will happen to you. What was impiety? It doesn't say. If I say, God damn, well, that's impiety. That I've just broken the law because you're not supposed to take the name of God in vain. Well, that's impiety. But they knew that it was too hard to specify in a law, you couldn't list all the ways that people could be impious. And so the idea was that the community, the jurors, the 500 people listening to this case, they would have to think, okay, we now know what this guy did. Do we consider that impiety? And so that's how the law worked for them. And there's an extraordinary subset of this whole discussion, which is that we have a number of places in the forensic speeches where somebody says, I've listened to my opponent, I feel sorry for him, and so I am not going to press my advantage here because he's a poor guy and he needs what he needs, and so I forgive him. We have cases like this. It's wonderful. It is wonderful. And there's one more point before we turn to Socrates, and that is, so the jury votes, and the vote is secret. In the assembly, the vote is public. You raise your hand. But in court, everybody gets a bean, a black bean or a white bean. And if you vote guilty, nobody can see which bean you have in your hands, but you put one in here and one in here. If you put the black one in here, that's guilty. And then they count the beans, and a majority decides. And we never hear anybody ever saying, you know, it was divided, there was dissension, they fought, it was decided as the vote of the community, and nobody then complained about it. Now, let's look at this most famous trial, Socrates. Socrates was an intellectual. There's a word that you all will have heard, and that is the word sophist. This is a much misused term. In the 5th century, as we were saying yesterday, in the 5th century, this was a general word for not even just intellectual. The word for intellectual was frontistes. Phroneo means to think, and so a frontistes is a thinker. And if you look in Aristophanes in the Clouds, where he attacks Socrates, he never calls Socrates a sophist, but he's a frontistes, he's an intellectual. It was Plato who made that word nasty. What Plato did was very clever. He took all the people he hated, all the intellectuals he hated, and called them sophists. He says all they do is teach rhetoric to make the worst cause seem the better. They charge money for their instruction. They would teach even a terrible person for money. And this is a travesty of justice. This is absolutely, it's a horrible thing that Plato did here. Socrates was an intellectual. And I should say first, we divide these people we know of because Plato was born in 428, thereabouts, and he knew about people who came the generation before him, people like Protagoras and Prodicus. These are the earlier sophists, as they're conventionally, but Plato didn't go beyond them, back further. But these figures had been around for 200 years. So there was this group of intellectuals working in all, not a group. To consider them a school is a mistake. Everybody was individual. Everybody had their own ideas. But after 430, the early ones were very positive. They wrote law codes for cities. They advised politicians. They spoke to the people. They were interesting figures. But then, in the death of Pericles, who was an aristocrat but a democratic leader, in 429, new politicians were lower class, and the aristocracy, always the nightmare of Greece, the aristocracy refused to compete in politics against the demagogues, who were this just like Pericles, except they were lower class, or middle class, if that word has any sense. So the upper classes and the intellectuals who hung around with them all went into aristocratic social clubs, which they called hetaireia, and conspired against the democracy. And it became a very dark period for intellectual history. This is where the idea might makes right, that if you're stronger, you decide what's fair. This occurs all through Thucydides. Might makes right. And in Aristophanes' Clouds, 423, right in this period, which attacks Socrates and all other intellectuals, this idea is discussed at length. And making the worst cause seem the better. There's a debate in Aristophanes' Clouds between wrong and right. And in this debate, wrong wins. It's a bad period, very negative period for intellectual activity during the Peloponnesian War. And Plato grew up in this negative period of intellectual speculation. He fell under the influence of an intellectual, Socrates, whom the Athenians considered the worst of these intellectuals. All philosophers who love Plato's Socrates. Plato spent his career making a wonderful portrait of a wonderful guy, but it's not historical. And the reason we all think well of Socrates is we read Plato's portrait, but the reality was something very different. Socrates, we know from Plato's own pages that he, during the war with Sparta, he was on Sparta's side. He was Philo-Laconian. He was anti-democratic. He despised the democracy. He says ordinary people like us should not be allowed to make decisions. He was an aristocrat. Plato conceals this because the aristocracy is in the process now of really disgracing themselves, because in these anti-democratic social clubs, they conspired against the democracy, and in 411 and in 404, they overthrew the democracy. And the last one of these, 404, after Athens lost the war with Sparta, the oligarchs, the 30 tyrants, took over, and many of them were Socrates' students. And they killed, there's no dispute in the sources, conservative sources, progressive sources, everybody says, they killed 1,500 people to steal their money. Plato, in the seventh letter, which may be authentic, Plato says, the rule of the 30 tyrants, some of whom were my relatives, some were my friends, made the previous democracy look like the rule of gold, the reign of gold. It was a nightmare. The democracy then fought back and drove out the 30 tyrants in 404. And it was a terrible civil war. And in 403, the democracy, after they had isolated the oligarchs in the city of Eleusis, the democracy decided, we're going to declare a general amnesty, because lawsuits about what happened in 404 would go on for many years. So, an amnesty. And they made it illegal to prosecute anybody for actions committed in 404 or before. So, in 399, Socrates is brought to trial. Socrates was the teacher of many of the 30 tyrants. He was anti-democratic. He was pro-Spartan. There is no Athenian says anything good about him until Plato, who loved him. So Socrates was brought to trial, and the charge was a religious one, that he didn't believe in the gods of the city, but he believed in strange new spiritual beings, and he corrupted the young. So, as I mentioned, there is a charge called impiety, which was undefined. Was Socrates impious? Certainly he was. No intellectual could believe in the gods of Homer and of Greek poetry and Greek tradition. And besides, the single thing that Socrates says always in Plato is that I know nothing. And his goal was to show anybody he talked to that they knew nothing too. You may think you know something, but just tell me something you know and I'll show you, you don't really know it. You think you know. And he angered a lot of people by poking fun at people who says, oh, I know something. And he would show them they did not know. So the idea that Socrates believed in the gods of the city is absurd. But did the Athenians care about that? They did not. Or let us say, most people did not. Because Pericles was an atheist. There were atheists all over the place because the Greeks were very, there was no creed. There were rituals you had to perform, but you could believe anything you wanted to. People in Euripides get up on stage and say, guess what, folks? The gods are invented by humans for various human purposes. They had heard everything. Did they care? They did not care. Or most people did not care. I will not deny there will have been some Athenians, especially the Athenians, they had lost the war. Maybe they had attracted the anger of the gods by Euripides' plays. And so it undoubtedly was an issue for some people. But it's not a serious issue. So, Socrates was brought to trial for impiety. Why? Because they had declared an amnesty. He could not be tried for collaborating with the 30 tyrants. The 30 tyrants were not excused. They were executed. When they caught them, they executed them because they were horrible murderers. I'm not a supporter of the death penalty, but the 30 tyrants were horrible people. And Socrates was their teacher. And continues to say in Plato, I hate democracy. I love Sparta. And he says in his defense speech, which Plato wrote, he says, if you let me go, I will continue to do what I always have done. This is very dangerous language. And even Plato has him say this. What Plato says in the Apology, the defense speech is, he has Socrates say, the 30 tried to involve me in their crimes. They called me to them and said, go arrest this guy called Leon and bring him to us. They wanted to steal his money. And Socrates says in the Apology, I said nothing and went home. Now, why did he say, even on Plato's account, why did he say nothing against this crime? Why did he not go to warn Leon? They're coming to get you. The sources that we have, what the Athenians outside of the court case. In Xenophon, Socrates' accuser observes that Socrates taught both Critias, who was the head of the 30 tyrants, the most greedy and violent of all the oligarchs, and Alcibiades, the most dissolute and arrogant of all the democrats. According to Xenophon again, Xenophon was one of Socrates' students. Socrates convinced the oligarch Charmides to enter politics, and Charmides was bad news. Isocrates reports that in 392, Polycrates argued that Socrates had been the teacher of Alcibiades. Aeschines expressly says the Athenians executed Socrates because he was the teacher of Critias, one of the 30 who put down the democracy. And Socrates' prosecutors were all ardent Democrats. So, what do we have here? I think the evidence is clear. And Xenophon constantly says, Socrates taught his students to detest the laws and the constitution of Athens. And they overthrew the democracy and killed 1,500 people for their money. So I would not blame the Athenians for thinking that Socrates was shared in the 30 tyrants' guilt. And here's something else most extraordinary. Xenophon says, Socrates gave a very weak and arrogant defense. It seemed to all of us that he wanted to die. He wanted to be convicted. And actually, in Plato's version of the defense speech, Socrates says repeatedly, I don't care if you kill me, because I don't know if death is good or bad. So why would Socrates say this? And why would he have an arrogant defense that made people think he wanted to be convicted? Why? And the answer is, he knew he was guilty. And he knew that if they let him go, he would, as Plato has him say, continue to behave as he's always behaved. He could do no other, but he knew he was guilty. And therefore he said, execute me. He brought this on himself. But there's one major question. The Athenians declared an amnesty in 403. So they prosecute Socrates on the religious charge, because he's still impious. He still would say, I don't believe in Zeus. I don't believe in the city's gods. That's a crime that's ongoing, not the 30 tyrants. So we can say that the Athenians actually, well, did they break their law? They charged him with impiety. They formally convicted him of impiety. But everybody knew that the real charge was his involvement with the 30 tyrants. But there had been the amnesty. There had been the amnesty. So they couldn't charge him with that. So they charged him with a crime that nobody took seriously. Did the Athenians break the rule of law? Arguably, they did. Arguably, in this one case, the community says, we don't care. He is guilty, and he did tremendous damage to Athens. And so we're convicting him on a charge that 10 years earlier, we never would have convicted him of, because it was an open society. People said all kinds of things. So it's an interesting case where I have come to the conclusion that the Athenians did actually break. Socrates was technically guilty, yes. But it's as if I said, God damn, I could be convicted, especially in the American South, where you're not supposed to say those words. But realistically, no. And so the religious charge was a cover for the political charge, which they ought not to have brought. But the community comes first. That's the fundamental. Laws are there to protect the community, and so the Athenians had no problem convicting. And of course, they did have a problem. The vote was close. If in 500 people, if 30 people had voted differently, Socrates would have been convicted. So that's extraordinary. And even in a case where Socrates probably wanted it, gave a terrible defense speech, we are told, and actually wanted to die, he almost got off. One final point, the second stage of the trial, what is the punishment? Because there are 500 jurors, they could never agree on a punishment. So the prosecution proposed a punishment, death in this case, the defense proposed a punishment, and the jury chose between them. And so Socrates first suggested punishment for himself was free meals from life for the city, because he thought, I've done good for the city. This is a monstrous, and his friend said, don't, please, the jury will never go for it. They'll never go for it. And so his friend said, all right, here's a little money. So Socrates offered a small amount of money as a fine. And more people voted to convict, to execute Socrates than judge that he was guilty. Why? The answer is simple. The community had decided he was guilty. And so therefore, it's perfectly reasonable for a juror to think, okay, I voted to acquit, but the community decided he was guilty. So I accept he's guilty. So what should be the punishment? So there, in a nutshell, is the trial of Socrates. Thank you.